Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Daniel McAnaspey was the first child to be killed while in the care of the state. Daniel had 20 different care placements in the 15 months before his death. State agencies, they knew he was in danger. They knew he needed secure accommodation, even perhaps abroad, for his own protection. However, he was repeatedly failed by many state agencies. And in 2010, at the age of just 17, he was murdered in a park. His inquest was only held this month, and it recommended a review of child welfare services, among other recommendations too. His older sister, Katrina McAnaspey, joins us now. Katrina, welcome. This has been a very long ordeal, hasn't it, for you and your family? Can I begin where, when you and Daniel, he was Dano to the family, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
Dano. When you were growing up, Finglas was home.
Yeah.
What are your memories of home in your childhood years?
We were young, we were all together. Happy times, but hard times as well.
How many of you, in terms of siblings, were in the family?
There's six of us.
And you were a couple of years older then?
Yeah, I'm Daniel's older sister, so I'm 4 years older than Daniel.
As you say, hard times as well. So there are happy memories. You and your siblings are taken into care in kind of stages, is that right?
No, we all went together. They came to me, Mam, and it was going to be a big family home. And my mum could come with us, so we'd be all together.
And it was just your mum at this stage because...
Yeah, my dad had passed away.
He had died and you were very young.
Christmas Day in 96.
Christmas Day?
Yeah.
Can I ask what happened to
him?
He
had a heart attack.
Really?
Yeah, so that's why my mum, obviously, she had six kids under the age of 10 on her own. And she fell on hard times herself, so that's why we ended up in...
Naturally there. Enough to difficult to survive losing your partner in life on a Christmas day with so many small children. And then your mother becomes unwell.
Yeah. She turned to drink, you know. So she did come with us to the house in Mount Pelier. We were all together and we were told we'd stay together. But unfortunately, me mum, you know, it was quite hard for seeing her kids, obviously, kind of taken off her.
Yeah.
So she turned to drink and she went to rehab, but she came out, she wasn't allowed back to the home with us, so...
Devastation that, again.
Yeah, so that took an effect on her, so she turned to alcohol, so...
Addiction essentially kills her.
Yeah.
What age are you when she dies?
I was 17.
Daniel, he wasn't even a teenager at this point.
No.
What happens then? Because you're kind of, do you break up as a family? What initially
well,
occurs?
Well, we were still living in Mount Pelier as a family, like as brothers and sisters, you know, and we were told we'd stay together. But unfortunately, when my mum left, we kind of started playing up. You know, we were told we'd be with her. So when she didn't get to come home to us, to the house, we kind of all started playing up, you know. I was missing school. I was going off with my friends and... Then eventually they just start taking us one by one out of the house. I was me first, then my sister, then me, I think it was Daniel. And then from that, there was me two younger brothers and sisters. They were left.
And is they the HSE? Because they're responsible for child welfare at the time.
Yeah.
Daniel, what was he, or Dano as you knew him, what was he like as a kid when you were all still together?
Oh, he was so funny. He just wanted to make everyone laugh.
Really?
All the time. Like, you couldn't be around him without laughing. Everything was a joke to him and he just wanted everyone to be, like, laugh all the time.
You were all close?
Yeah, very close.
But were you able to put manners on him at all? As then?
Yeah, he would listen, yeah.
He
would, mind you. But then when I moved out, you know, his older sister is gone now. His mum is gone. So he found it very hard because we were really close. So he did find it hard.
Everyone found it difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, you turned to drink yourself.
I did.
In your early teenage years.
Hanging around parks. Yeah. So, yeah, you just want your family. Like, so my mother, like, you know, as much as she had her own problems, but we still loved her, you know.
She just had an illness, you know, she was in grief. She had the illness of addiction.
Maybe if they, you know, said that the help they she could have got as well, maybe.
How do you get your life together? Because you do very quickly, don't you? Thankfully, the
well, I did. I ended up in a girls' hostel in Ballymun. I had left school at that point. I wasn't going. I just kind of gave up. But I went there and I just kind of taught my life around by the help of Finola Dolan. She was brilliant.
Was Finola Dolan? She was the
like ran the girls' hostel. So she would have been in our family previous to my own brothers and sisters. My two aunties lived there before us many years ago. So
she organised education, everything for you, didn't she?
Yeah, she got me back into school and I ended up doing me leaving. And then I was still after that, I was saying I was leaving. She just kept pushing me and I was the first Mac and Aspie to do me leaving cert.
You must look at that kid that you were back then.
Yeah, I do.
What an achievement.
Well, yeah, I wish I had done further, but I got to me leaving, so I'm happy with that.
With everything that had gone on. Yeah. So you got your life together. Nikita was another younger sister of yours.
Yeah, she came then to live with me in the girls' hostel. She also done her leaving as well. Like,
and how stable was your lives together at that point?
Well, we had each other, so it was kind of good, you know. Mm. And we had each other. Like that, Daniel and my brother Keith, they were very, very close.
Yeah.
So they had each other. And then when they got split,
yeah,
that was really, really hard for both of them. One went to live with me auntie Pamela and, well, Keith. And then obviously Daniel was moved around. That's when it kind of starts.
Because we can see when you got help, you and Nikita, that your life comes together and you go on to have a normal life despite the horrible trauma and grief in your life. The documents that come out of the inquest show that the failings really begin for Daniel when he's taken into care, isn't he? He loses education effectively as a result of simple things not being noticed, like he had dyslexia.
Yeah, like in the inquest, like, we heard a child that has dyslexia, you should be second class, you know, where that they should have known. But Daniel was like,
it's an easy thing to sort out, to educate people with dyslexia.
So, I think he was like 14, 15 before that came.
And that's when they realised, but at that stage he can't read or write.
No, and from a very young age, that's all he ever wanted to do.
It's very sad because he liked school.
Yeah, yeah, he really, really did. He wanted to learn. Hmm. And, you know, obviously his little mind, and he didn't realise, why can't they? But he was never told. He obviously knew he couldn't read and write, and that, like, he was embarrassed about that.
Really?
Yeah, he was very embarrassed about that. Like, so that's one thing he really wanted to do, was to read and write.
Like, to carry that shame around him, it's just appalling, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because that's the simplest thing in the world to fix. And it was just dyslexia. Lots of people have very, very intelligent people as well.
Yeah.
He had a positive regard for school. He leaves school, obviously, because he's not taken care of there. And he ends up living in the streets, essentially. He's even attacked quite dangerously, isn't he?
Yeah, he got 14. Stabbed when he was 14 in the neck.
In the neck?
Yeah, in the neck. Roaming the streets of the city centre.
He ends up in Temple Street Children's Hospital.
He did, yeah.
Where was he living then at that stage? Do you know where he was sleeping?
No, I'd imagine it was the out of service. But after that, that's when my auntie Sabrina took Daniel.
You had great aunties.
Yeah, they were brilliant and still are brilliant to us.
And I'm sure they had their own things going on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they had a lot of trauma in their own lives, you know, but they stood by us all.
So Auntie Sabrina's trying to take in Daniel around this time. He's been attacked and injured on the street. He doesn't have any school. But then Daniel, being a nice kid, he doesn't really want to be a burden to Auntie Sabrina. Is that right?
No, he was in with my other aunties, a couple of them before that. But like that, there's no space. They had their own kids, you know, they still took him. But after then, the attack on him, Sabrina did take him, and he lived with Sabrina for like 2 years.
Right.
And she got him into FOSS, the Youth Centre.
Yeah.
He was doing well, but it broke down again because, like, no one came to Sabrina to see how Daniel was, see were they okay. He was just left there and
there was no follow-up or connection to who...
Not really, no, no.
And there's an incident in the FOSS course, which again comes back to the shame of his dyslexia, not being able to read or write, and this has a profound impact on him.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, like that, he wanted to read and write, and there was, like, obviously a group in his FOSS, and he just got embarrassed, like, if he had to read out or...
He was asked to read something out loud, was that?
Yeah, it was something like that. And like that, he was embarrassed that he couldn't do it. Like, so that he left.
He leaves the court, and that's the only stable thing, really.
That really was,
yeah. So naturally, he ends up back on the streets, about 15 years of age. People will be familiar with the chaotic life of people in this area, particularly who work in this area, someone with no education, no work. He's a young teenager. Drugs are readily available on the streets, and that's
and
what happens.
And that's what he turned to, yeah. You know, he's a 15-year-old on the streets. You know, all he's looking for is a family, somewhere safe. He had us as a family, but I mean, he knew, he felt, always felt that he was a burden to us, like, as in,
you were getting on with your life.
Nice. Yeah, and you know, he wanted, he knew there was never room, and he just wanted the HSE just to provide him with security, you know. So,
did you have much contact with him during that time?
Yeah, all the time. You wouldn't, you know, he was always around us.
Yeah. He really desperately wants help. He's taking tablets, smoking cannabis. There was a suicide attempt.
Yeah, I didn't know that until I heard it in the inquest.
You didn't know that until now, really?
Yeah, I didn't know that about the suicide attempt. I heard that in court, so.
What do you know about it? Is he taken to hospital? Does he get any care?
I think he was taken to hospital, yeah, to Temple Street, and there was nothing they could do for him or something, so. Again, he was left on the streets.
He's back out even after that.
And that's when I think he knew himself, he needed help and he wanted to help. And
along the way, the HSE appoints, or there's someone appointed by the courts, is that right? The HSE to represent Daniel in legal proceedings. He's not taking drugs, I believe, for this period.
No, they drug test him and it came back clear.
So he was fighting to live and
he
to survive.
He really was.
How does he get someone appointed to him in the end? What?
Well, Aileen was appointed to all of us, I think, when my mum passed away. So we were...
I see, there is a contact there.
Yeah, we didn't need her anymore. So she was gone. But the social workers went back and asked her for help to be Daniel's voice.
Okay.
So that's how she comes back on the scene.
So little bits of the system work here. And Aileen Dunn is her name.
Yeah. Yeah.
Formidable, brilliant woman.
Yeah.
And really cares about her
job.
She
really did, and she really tried her best.
She had lovely things to say about your brother.
Yes, and she got very, very upset in court.
In the inquest.
A couple of times.
What did she tell you, the inquest, about Daniel?
He was like that, funny. Like that, he wanted help, and she knew that. And she was his voice, and she, like, Daniel kept saying to her, like, I really need somewhere to go, and she fought for that, and... It never happened.
She said he didn't have a bad bone in his body. And that was important because when he, and the way he's killed in the end, all sorts of rumours swirl about anyone who is even just adjacent to drugs. Or
a lot of people has came out and kind of said Daniel was murdered over a drug debt. That's not true.
Totally false. Yeah.
Daniel was in the, like, ended up in Blanche that night to meet a girl and just came across these two guys, and that's why he was killed. Like, but it was nothing got to do with drugs or anything like that.
Aileen Dunn, nobody really works harder than her. She pushes for secure accommodation over and over again, doesn't she?
Yeah.
How badly is the state failing in this regard? How many attempts are made to get him accommodation?
There was like 3 or 4 applications, and every one of them were refused. And she said he met all the ticks that. For someone to be in a secure unit, Daniel met each and every one of those ticks for him to be in a secure unit.
Because he was in danger.
Yeah.
And repeatedly the state has told over and over.
What child asks to be locked up? You know, he asked that.
Yeah.
For, you know, he wanted help, and that was the only way out. Lock me up, help me.
Again, at the time, it's not TUSLA, which is the organisation people are familiar with these days, it's the HSE Care Committee. They're told 3 times in the year before he's murdered that he needs somewhere safe, but there was no bed. Is that the reason?
This is what we've been told. There was no beds available for Daniel.
There was talk about sending him to Sweden to a treatment care.
Yeah, Sweden. And that was refused.
There was a clinical psychologist who spoke to the inquest, and he met Daniel 20 times. I think it was. You'd never heard from this person before.
I never heard his report, and that shocked me.
What did you find out?
A lot. That Daniel had post-traumatic stress disorder. He had the... I'm forgetting the word. he had a few things going on. And just one that stuck out with me was the fact that he was in court the day before my Daniel was murdered, like saying this child needs to be put away, like locked up for his own safety. He's not
the day before.
The day before. And that shocked me.
And this took 15 years for you to find out.
Yeah. And he had said in his report that if he didn't get anywhere safe, that he wouldn't make it 12 months. And the next day, Daniel's murdered.
It's extraordinary. He knew exactly what was going on. And I believe that psychologists had never written that in a report before about a kid in these circumstances.
Yeah.
That's how much danger Daniel
was in.
McInaspy was
and
in.
And I was, that has stuck with me since the day at court, because like I blamed myself for many, many years.
God, yeah.
You know, and, but it's kind of given me, I shouldn't blame myself, because it was HSC that should have been really protecting him, not me. He was under their care.
It's very clear now. How do you know in February 2010 that Daniel is missing?
We couldn't get through to him.
Right, because he was so used to contact.
Yeah. And from there, yeah.
He's missing for quite some time, isn't he, before you find out what happened?
12, 13 weeks.
What are those weeks like?
Oh, morning to night, we searched fields, ditches. We searched the whole of Blanchardstown, day in, day out. There wasn't a day we did not go out. And I had a young daughter at the time, and she didn't get to see her mammy for 3 months because my focus was to find Daniel. So that, you know, it took a lot on us, searching every day. Like, we were never going to give up, but...
And 3 months later, you get the worst news.
Yeah, that he was found in a ditch.
Do you remember being told, or how you found out on that day?
Well, I think they came to us and told us they found a remains of a body. So obviously it took a few days to say it was Daniel. But yeah, I was happy that we had him.
Really?
Because we've been searching. I was devastated that what happened to him, but we had him home, you know, with us.
So you knew that he had been murdered, but the body was moved.
Yeah.
And that's when he was finally tracked down. When it occurred, I presume you always had hope that he would have a normal life at some point.
Yeah.
Were you always fearful? Did you always half think this might happen?
Not murdered, no. I always knew he was in danger, hanging around town.
Yeah.
I suppose there was always danger for Daniel, you know, where he was hanging around, but still a shock to us that he was murdered.
Teenage boys, 17 years of age, they don't get murdered every day in Ireland, thankfully. It was a brutal murder. The circumstances of moving the body were horrific. Two men responsible were convicted. There were many trial delays here, which must have been very difficult for you as well. Richard Decker from Blanchardstown in 2017, he's convicted of murder. He was sentenced to life in prison. This was after a retrial, and then he'd an appeal that reached all the way to the Supreme Court. That was rejected just 3 years ago. Trevor Noon, also from Blanchardstown, was convicted of manslaughter. He was sentenced to 13 years. He served 6 years and was released in 2023. Extraordinary. This must have made your grief ever more difficult.
Yeah, it is. It's like he's living his life now. We're still fighting for our brother, Daniel. No, we're Daniel's voice now, but he's out.
Trevor Noon is out.
He's out now, like,
Richard,
you know.
Decker is still in prison.
Yeah.
Did you ever find out why they did it?
They're evil. They've done a lot of things to other people, you know. Daniel was just out there having a kid, trying to meet a girl, and he just happened to meet this, and...
And that's it?
They thought Daniel had nobody, like family, or he obviously mentioned he lived in care or whatever, and they just...
An opportunistic killing. The fight for justice then turns to how the state didn't protect him. The murders in 2010, the inquest has only just happened. Very upsetting to go through it all again.
Yeah. Just brings it all back, and, you know, like, obviously we know about the murder and we knew a lot, you know, but I was just shocked in the inquest to hear some stuff I didn't even know, like the doctor's report, and just like it's just horrible.
It's like there are two trains of justice here. You've had the criminal one, and those people have criminal responsibility. But then you just have the care the state should have provided, and they didn't. Mm. But it was, I presume, a moment of justice to have a jury agree with you.
Oh, yes, that was. And I'd like to thank the jury. Yeah, it was great that we had them on our side, you know, and they could see how wrong Daniel was let down, you know. So it was really nice that they were on our side.
So their overall verdict, obviously unlawful killing, but the recommendations they gave is that the state should carry out a review of its funding to child protection services by TUSLA to ensure it has the ability to keep children safe. They said the child's voice should be front and centre. That was really important to you, wasn't it?
Yes.
Does the state today, that was 2010, it's now 15 years on, does the state have the ability, the HSC, TUSLA, to stop this from happening again?
I really, really hope, but you know, as you said, Daniel was murdered in 2010. We're now 2025 and there's still kids waiting for beds. Mm. You know, it was the HSC when that happened to Daniel, TUSLA took over and nothing has changed. In all those years, you think something would change.
In terms of the level of care.
Yeah.
The inquest heard there are four young people who've been approved by the High Court for special care. They still were awaiting placement at the time of the inquest. And we also heard that due to a lack of staff, only 14 of 26 specialist care beds in the state's three facilities are open. We only have 26 beds. We can only open 14.
Yeah. That's shocking.
It is genuinely shocking.
It really is.
Considering what's happened already in the past, what do you want to happen next?
I really, really hope TUSLA wake up and help these young kids, because it won't be long before someone else ends up dead, like, and I really, really don't want another family to have to go through this again, because the heartache we've went through for 15 years, I just couldn't imagine another family going through it. It's really sad. So I really hope they open their eyes and things really, really change, you know.
That's for the present and future kids in care. What do you want the state to say to the McAnaspey family?
We've never had an apology off them. In 15 years, they've never came to us. They've never offered us counselling. They've never offered us any of my family to see how we've done in these 15 years. Mm. Nothing from them.
You could do with counselling?
Yeah, honestly, I could. You know, it's 15 years, but, you know, they probably thought we were going away. But we're not going away, you know. We're still fighting for Daniel's voice and we will continue to do that.
It seems like a simple request, doesn't it? A formal state apology.
Yeah.
For failings that a jury has agreed with of our fellow citizens.
Mm.
It's very clear that the failings have been laid out. That's all you're looking for.
Yeah.
Are you going to take on the HSC for the failings of the past as well?
It was never, ever in my mind. But after the inquest and what I heard and how bad they failed Daniel, that's something I'm looking into.
In terms of a legal action?
Yeah.
Because you were not told so much about his care and the failures of the care.
You know, and they need to be held accountable. So, you know, I really think they need to, yeah, be held accountable. And I'm, you know, as I said, we never got a sorry. We've never been offered support, help in 15 years. So, yeah. I am going to.
People will be shocked by that. Let's go back to Daniel, because he would have been 30, wouldn't he, 2 years ago?
32 years ago, yeah.
Your family came together for his what would have been his 30th at the grave. What did you do that day?
We got a big banner. We brought champagne with his picture on it. Yeah, we just celebrated him. Sad, but we had all our little kids with us that never met Daniel, but they all know him.
Go ahead, yeah.
And they all singing and, you know, let balloons off for him, and it was quite hard, but seeing our little ear kids now known of their uncle or their cousin celebrating his life, it was lovely to see, but also very hard.
Yeah, but they get to know him a bit, don't they?
Yeah, they like, you'd ask any of the children in our family Daniel and they would all tell you, they all feel like they've met Daniel, you know, but they haven't, but they'll talk like they did.
That's a lovely scene that you're painting for us, and all the McNaspies are your close knit family still.
Oh yeah.
And all gathered for little Dano.
Yeah. Sad. We do it every year, but that was, we made that one special because, you know,
of course, yeah,
he would have been 30.
He was only 17. How are you now? How are you in
yeah,
your life?
I'm good. You know, I have two kids, so all good. But, you know, last week, you know, it's bringing a lot back. So I'm just trying to take a step, you know, for myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
it must be incredible because I think one of your kids only turning 17 at the moment.
Yeah, that hurts me at the minute. I'm scared just to see her, you know, her age was Daniel's age when he was murdered. So it's quite, you know, you're, don't do this, don't do that, don't go there. You know, it's not her fault. But at the same
time, she's still a kid to you.
Yeah, and I've, you know, you never get over that fear of something bad happening.
Really, that's still in there.
Oh, yeah. And when you have a daughter that age, that fear will never go. I don't think it ever will.
You're an extraordinary woman, you know that.
Thanks.
And Nikita, who came with you here today as well, like, incredible woman. To get through that, it's just extraordinary. But to keep on fighting at the level you're doing at it now, we can only wish you well. I know it's been a difficult time, even coming to chat to us today.
Thanks for having us.
Not at all. Absolutely amazed by you. And I'm delighted to hear that everything is well in your life. And we can just wish you well.
Thanks very much.
He'd be very proud of his big sister, I'm sure.
I hope so.
And for the work you're doing for the other kids as well. You couldn't do any more. Katrina McAnaspie, thank you so much. And a reminder to people out there that supports are available on rte.ie/helplines.